It's the Daily Talk Show, episode 330.
It's Easter Monday.
Hey, boys. It's Lewis good to Spears. Be here.
How are you?
I'm very good, man. I was. This place is really cool, this little setup.
Mm. Isn't it funny? Because we think it's a piece of shit.
No, it's great, dude. My stuff, I've rented a warehouse in the brothel capital of Melbourne. So this shit's on it, really.
Where is the brothel capital of Melbourne?
If you read a few news articles, you may find something about a man being found in a bin that was murdered 15 years ago. It's around there.
Okay. Really? Well, one
it's
of the
terrifying.
Other, I know where you are, but the other one is also South Melbourne. A lot of brothels.
Yeah. South Melbourne's a weird area because I feel like South Melbourne's a social experiment because we do a radio show around there. It's like a weird experiment where it's like, let's get like the richest 30-year-old white women and put them right next to everyone in housing commission and just see what happens. It's like a social experiment. It's great.
It used to be horrible. Like it used to be a really shitty area. I think that's what's
And then they got the housos in and it got heaps better.
Well, this area, Collingwood, used to be an absolute dump.
Mm. And look at it now.
And now.
But the people are still around, you know. Like I saw walking here, I walked past, there were like two dudes sitting on the pavement smoking weed, like opposite to a bar that has free board games. And I'm like, you know, just play chess, boys.
Full hipster area. Lewis Spears, people might know you from the interweb. I know you from Family Christmas.
Yes.
Quite a few years back when we did it at Claire Faulkner's place.
I have a photo. I brought one in.
Do you? Of you and I?
Yeah.
Fuck. So we're basically family. Brother's wife is Lewis's cousin. So my sister-in-law.
Okay.
Sister. So my sister have to like each other.
So my sister-in-law is Lewis's cousin.
There it
cousin.
Is. There's us Holy at shit. Family dinner.
God, Lewis, I was so hungover that day. I barely made that.
Can I'd I have gone a look, out. Please? Can we put this on our Instagram?
Is that up the back there?
That's me up the back looking depressed in the crown.
How old were you then?
Oh, I don't even know. My mum sent that to me. That would have been like maybe 17 or 18.
Yeah, so that was for me pre-Shepparton days. And I remember talking to you that day about you wanting to get into radio and get into media and starting your career. And you fucking launched hard over that time.
Yeah, well, I'm trying. I feel like just this year it's starting to feel big now, which is cool.
Yeah. Like, well, it's been exciting watching. I've been seeing you from afar and seeing your stand-up comedy. Josh said to me, was it stand-up for Lewis first or was it the internet stuff?
I always wanted to do stand-up. Like since I was 12, I saw Leno and Woodley live and I thought, I want to do that. And but I kind of fell into online stuff at 18. Mm. I just started doing videos and mucking around and fucking with the media. And I think it took me a whole year of doing that before I realized, oh, this is comedy too. Yeah. And I can leverage this into getting people to come to shows and I can start stand-up. So it was kind of weird. Like I always wanted to do stand-up. I did online shit by accident and then got this small audience. And I thought, well, I can get them to a show, but I have no idea how to do stand-up. So I just started doing stand-up for a whole year in secret because there's the last thing you want is for people to come out and you suck.
Yeah. Where did you go? Come back. Where were you doing the secret stand-up?
I just did open mics all around Melbourne. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, as many times a week I get on stage. And I still do that. I still do all the same rooms that I used to because there's only one comedy club in Melbourne and you can only really get on there maybe twice a week. And if you want to work on your act, you've got to be up every night. So just lots of shithole bars.
Well, there's worse things you could do in secret, like heroin.
Yes. Or playing chess.
You mentioned the stuff about the media, sort of fucking with the media. Mm. I mean, if Josh's mum and dad are watching, they might know you from ACA.
Oh, yes. That's right. Yeah, mum and dad are big Current Affair. Yeah.
I wonder if they saw back in the day when you were on ACA.
It's funny, that whole period of time. It just that doing that, if you don't know, basically a group I was in, we tricked a Current Affair into running a fake story about how we were bullying someone. That person turned out to be a member of our group. Mm-hmm. And it really just demonstrated how little time they have for research. Like they don't have time for research. If you think about a Current Affair and Today Tonight, they got to do 4 stories 5 days a week. Mm. Like we sent an email in, we had a whole plan and a backstory and we did a conversation map. We sent an email in, we got one back going, great, can you meet us in 2 hours at this park? And we were like, okay. And then it was on TV that night.
Jesus.
You didn't even have to show them any of the stuff that you'd planned.
No, felt like a big waste of time, really, trying to counter their research that evidently was non-existent. Yeah.
Well, I saw you, they sent a text message to the girl that was in it saying, do you have any photos of the conversations? Uh-huh. And she just said no. And they're like, no worries, that's fine.
Yeah.
But they still run the story. It's crazy. I think when you did that, it's almost so many people are doing that now, tricking the media. But that was kind of a little bit before it's become kind of real popular to fuck with the media.
Yeah, well, it is kind of interesting, like seeing all of it happen now. After we did it, it's really cool. I think it's great. You know,
it's a whole genre.
If we could inspire some of that, that's great. You know, because all it was for me that it eventuated was it. I think it just teaches people that maybe you shouldn't believe everything you hear because if it's that easy to trick someone into saying some fake stuff. When they're saying things they think are true, maybe they're not actually because they haven't been researched properly.
Yeah. It was the OG fake news.
Yeah. It was real, actual fake news.
Did you, the stepping stone that online was to radio, did it change your perception once you're actually in radio and actually considering the fact that maybe it wasn't, maybe it is the thing rather than the step?
Not really. No, doing radio for us, me and Luke, we do a show called Luke and Lewis. Radio for us was is just an excuse to do more content online. Mm. You know, it's like to just get our voice out to a demographic that we wouldn't reach before. You know, we got a podcast now. We film every show, and it's just a chance to get more stuff out. And me and Luke are like really, really good friends, and we'd be hanging out talking shit anyway. We might as well, you know, put it on radio. And I suppose that we don't, you know, we're on Fox FM. They're not known for their journalism, you know. We're not exactly doing news or anything like that. I don't think anyone there is. So didn't really change.
What about the newsroom?
Yeah, there is a newsroom. Is there? I believe.
Could never been in there. Yeah. I don't know if anyone goes in there.
Is there like what's been the learning around content? Have you had like content directors or people supporting and teaching the way?
Yeah. Well, what's really good about working for SCA, who own Hit and Fox, is they're great at nurturing talent and just teaching us to avoid pitfalls. And like what we really learned from doing radio is that you can work a lot harder than you think you can. Like you can actually turn on funny if you can get into a room and you can structure try and harness the chaos of funny and stupid. You can really control it a little bit. Mm. So I think just getting in a room and having that planned structure of the show goes for 40 minutes, so we need 8 talk breaks that go for 5 minutes. So what are your 8 subjects that you're going to talk about today? And just learning about, you know, how me and Luke work. Like we kind of worked out that at the start we would tell each other our ideas and you'd almost do it in the meeting and then you get on air and you would just try and recreate what it was. But we also needed to talk through our ideas to make them better.
Yeah.
So we just kind of got to the point where I'd be like, okay, we're going to do my ideas. Luke leaves the meeting room. I told the producers, I got to work through it. They still helped me modify it, make it a bit better. And then when Luke hears it, you know, he knows that it's planned and he can actually hear it for the first time and react more organically.
Yeah, oh, that was always the problem. I mean, we didn't even have a producer when I was doing my show in Shepparton.
Yeah.
But it's always like, if you do it the other way, you almost need to run through your ideas with your co-host for a certain amount of time. But then it sounds like amateur radio, which it is.
It's like we tried to pre-record our shows and then I just got so into trying to work out what day it was and what potentially could have happened. So now we don't pre-record. We're just here on Monday doing the show right now.
Yeah, Easter Monday. Amazing, right?
Did you get many eggs?
I didn't get any eggs, bro.
No eggs.
No eggs. No. My family doesn't celebrate Easter. No? They think it's blasphemous. Eggs, everyone's allergic to it.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you guys have fish on Friday? Because that's a no-go.
Well, we had Fat Fridays and we had the
what do we have again?
I can't remember. No. Anyway, the
the main thing is no pre-recording goes on here.
No way. Not on public holidays, never.
Potentially. So from radio, stand-up, or like what are the commonalities then in all of this?
I would just say the commonalities is just the most important thing is to be genuine. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of always been my thing of like, I'm just going to try and be as honest as I can with the people that like me. And obviously funny as I can. Like that would just suck if I rocked up and told everyone what I had for breakfast and then went through my day without
that
any jokes.
That sounds like our podcast. That sounds a lot like...
No, that's your food diary. Food diary.
You can have fun with it.
Yeah. Can
it's
you?
It's like everyone has to have breakfast so everyone can relate to it.
What did you have for breakfast?
Today I actually had... I went coffee... So I had I got a Mocha Master recently.
Yeah.
And so I...
You got a... What is that?
A Mocha Master is like
a... You got it from the guys that were playing chess.
No, it's a drip coffee. So you put the coffee in and it like drips in and then...
This is like, the most early 30s conversation I've ever had in my life. It's bro, really I walked in here and I think I may have had the most boring conversation with you I've ever had in my life.
Was it the Marley
where
Stone
Josh or? Told me about how he bought 8 pairs of Skechers in America.
That's
if you're going
true.
To America and the only thing you come back with is pairs of Skechers, your trip sucked.
Why do you have two? Why do you think you get 2 bags of luggage, a US and one's for the Skechers? I believe that's the case. Do you ever feel... Because you do stuff that is slightly controversial.
Yeah.
We're pretty like,
not as controversial as wearing Skechers. Fuck, man. That's brave.
You gave him that one, Josh.
Yeah, I did. I don't own any of the Skechers, but I stand by.
What did you do with 8 pairs of Skechers?
I actually gave them to my girlfriend's dad.
And he's so never worn a
and
pair.
And he's like, man.
And that's why he'll never come to the wedding.
Exactly.
He's like, this cunt gave me 8 pairs of Skechers. I'm not walking her down the aisle.
No, I feel like he's into it. I think that is like, because they sort of look like they're like, oh, there's like they're a bit formal.
No, mate. Like no, mate. He was being polite.
But you know what they sell you on at Skechers is like you press.
You have to walk in for them to sell you on it.
Exactly. No, but you press like the sole and it's like real cushiony. Like it's like a full, it's like memory foam.
Still, right. It looks like you've got a foot roller on the bottom.
So you walk into the Skechers store and they go, look, I know they look like shit, but put your finger in the shoe and you go, this is great. Am I ever going to put my finger in the shoe again? And they go, no, generally your foot. And you're like, I'm sold. Why is everyone making fun of me?
Well, the get one 50% off, like buy one, get one 50% off.
Yeah.
Like
still doesn't equal 8.
Yeah. Well, no, if you get 4 and then anyway, it doesn't matter. But so controversial. We've all done.
How much money did you spend on Skechers?
I reckon probably like it was the way that I justified it is probably $400.
$400 on Skechers.
Yeah.
You know, the staff laughed at you when you left.
No, but they're all into it. They're really like they're part of it's
the cult.
They're definitely feels. It feels like the same sort of breed as people who are into like.
So it's like the Apple store, but
not cool. Very
I
not
will
cool.
say, Lewis, there is at times that this friendship and this trait in a friend actually pays off.
Yeah.
Why? When he gives you his shit.
But
when
Skechers?
Too much. No, not Skechers.
Nikes. Well,
I'm
this
glad
is
that I wasn't around.
I was like, I had a rebrand and so I bought some new shoes, which
you
were
had
Nike.
A rebrand.
Yes, I had a
Are
rebrand.
Are you a flagship store?
Yeah, absolutely. A little bit.
What
little
was your brand before Skechers?
My brand before was, That was
must have been a shit brand if Skechers is an upgrade.
No, the Skechers were sort of pre-rebrand. So I used to be sort of, I used to be 120 kilos. Yeah. I would sort of, I would go comfort or whatever. So like 3XL would give me room to move and things like that.
Hats. You look like a small young American boy who was traveling in a Winnebago.
Yeah, because I wore America. Like, I got some like checkered sort of shirts or whatever. But
it was
so
like Macca's playground attire.
Yeah, very much that. And so I went from like the snapbacks and stuff to something more minimal.
Mm.
And so now I'm trying to go for more sort of like a Steve Jobs-esque.
That's good.
Look.
Yeah.
Without
all the terminal illness.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. But I do, we've spoken about on the show, he's the gaunt, had a sort of...
He had that because he had cancer.
It's not really a look you want to go for, is it?
But
like, I really want to look like Steve Jobs. Fuck a diet. I'm just going to go out in the sun.
just that sort of lean look where it's like, oh, you haven't overdone it. You're not sort of... Like, you've got that look. Like, because like with your height...
Well, I look like someone dying of cancer.
No.
Fuck, I'm leaving.
I think it's great. Like, it's the aspirational. It's because you could wear anything, I think.
Well, I struggle finding pants that are long enough.
Yeah. Well, Lewis is 6'8".
Yeah.
Are you really 6'8"?
Yeah.
Only?
2 meters.
I felt like, because Tommy was talking it up, like, mate, this is what we're going to look like, mate. And then you came in, I was like, I don't like.
Dude, we're usually the tallest in the room majority of the time.
Mm. Like, it wasn't over.
My knees hurt sitting on this desk.
Yeah.
Well, so do mine too. But on the height thing very quickly, is the, when you're on a plane, is it like a,
annoyance.
Is it a medical issue? Like, do you have to get upgraded, like, based on the law?
I don't do the robot check-in, because if a human checks me in, I always get the free upgrade because they go, oh, poor bastard. Because I only fly Tiger, so they're like, you know.
Poor bastard, and we'll also help him out.
Yeah. So where did Tiger put you? They just put you in the aisle or something?
They put me in the emergency lane and they go, are you willing and able to help in an unlikely event of an emergency? And I go, it's Tiger, pretty likely, firstly. And also, yes, but my fingers are crossed. I'm not helping. I'll open the door and then I'm getting out and everyone else can, you know, burn. I'm not helping.
You posted on your Instagram today. I was going to say today, but that was probably a week ago.
Mm-hmm. This one's pre-recorded. We don't pre-record.
Yeah, can we give up on that? Okay, yeah, that's good.
It's too much mass.
I can't lie.
Today, which is the day we're on.
Yeah. Easter Monday.
Easter Monday. About how 30 of your followers are tall people fetish pages.
Yeah, I have. There's a website out there. Don't go on it. It's called tallguysfree.com, and I am the thumbnail and the most popular person in the tall and lanky category.
What's the free bit?
I think it's free. So you know,
look at Mr. 97.
Take that, Netflix.
Jeez.
Perv on. Apparently, incredibly tall men is a fetish.
And so, have they got photos of you?
Yeah, there's photos. Every single photo I've ever taken with my top off, and there's not that many. Like, they've gone through my whole Instagram. Mm. Most of them are just me doing jokes. Like, there's one where I put myself next to someone wearing a ridiculous outfit, and then they crop the other person out, and then they just put my topless photo up there of me on the beach. It's a bit weird, isn't it?
It's very fucking weird.
Do they at least give you like a link for search engine optimization?
Yeah, they do. They credit me. So I don't know if anyone's going from wanking over my spine length to laughing at my comedy. But, you know, it's a market.
Yeah. I think like the SEO thing is actually could be quite good. If they're linking off.
You're essentially being trolled. It's
I know.
It's you're being celebrated. I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, but without his permission.
Yeah,
I mean that's.
I think it's
that's
okay.
The state of what it is. What do you feel about it?
I don't know. I think it's funny.
Yeah, I guess.
It just points out that there's a fetish for everything, man. Like everything's a fetish. I knew tall people were like, oh, he's tall, that's good. Mm. But I didn't know that anyone's been like jacking off to just height.
It's a weird thing that I'm all about centimeters.
Well, they'd be good. Yeah. They'd be into like basketball and stuff, you'd think. Like they'd love like
Shaq.
Dude,
watch basketball. There's people that are taller than me and they don't look like Steve Jobs. Go there.
What we've worked out is Josh is actually really into that.
Yeah, so. No, I like the look. I like the look.
He's actually built the website.
Yeah, exactly. I wasn't going to reveal it. But the controversial stuff. Do you get anxiety around like the fact that there's a portion of the population that dislike what you've done? So like the anti-vaxxer one, for instance.
No, I just think it's funny.
Yeah.
I don't know. End of the day, I've only ever been yelled at once in public, and it wasn't that scary. Like it wasn't even for anything that I did. Like content-wise, it's pretty funny. It happened years and years ago.
Cut someone off at a car park.
I was on the train and I was just by myself and these two girls came up to me and they were like, oh, are you Lewis? And I said, yeah, how are you going? And then one of them sat on my knee to get a photo, which was, you know, a bit too touchy for me, but whatever. So she got the photo and then she walked back to her boyfriend.
Oh, gee.
And he saw that and he was not happy. And this is like a Friday night. I'm by myself. I think they might have had something to drink. And I got up to get off at my stop. And to get off at my stop, I had to walk towards the group. And the guy looks at me and he goes, oi, are you Lewis Spears? I said, yeah, man, how you going? He goes, you're not funny. You're shit.
That's way low level.
Yeah. And
that's
I was great. Like, oh. Sorry, man.
Yeah.
And then the doors open and then he goes, yeah, fucking run away, you pussy. And I just said, dude, I'm not going to miss my stop to punch you. I'm going home, man. Yeah. I got a book I want to read. I don't want to, you know, potentially lose a fight just for something because you called me a pussy. And then he I'm getting off the train and he goes, no one likes you, can't. And I said, your girlfriend does. And the doors closed. And then I think that may have been the end of it.
Did you touch off?
No, I didn't touch off. I felt too alpha.
There's a massive difference between what people will say in real life versus the internet. Your comedy special, death threats don't scare me. So you legit got death threats?
Yeah, so...
They're online ones, though. They weren't online person? Ones.
Yeah, because even that guy yelling at me, fair enough. Mm. You know, he wasn't angry about something that I did. He was angry because his girlfriend sat on my leg. And yeah. That's whatever. I'd be mad.
Did she post the photo? Did you get tagged in
yeah,
it?
Yeah, she like tagged me in it.
Really? So did you click through the boyfriend?
Disrespectful on her, I would think.
Yeah, give him a follow.
I feel like your problem's maybe not with me, dude. Yeah. It'd be her.
Yeah.
But yeah, the death threats thing, you just get them. Mm. And you kind of learn some of them. The only ones that can get a little bit, and I talked about this in my comedy special, the only ones that get a little bit scary are the ones that are specific. Mm. Like I did a joke about the Dreamworld accident that like the day it happened. And it went nuts. Most people thought it was funny, but obviously a lot of people think it's angry, which just goes with the territory. But I got all these death threats, but only one scared me, which was, I see you coming to the Gold Coast on April 14. I'm going to be there with a knife.
Oh, gee.
Saw that one and I thought, oh, a little bit spooked. Yeah, I don't know if I'll do the meet and greet after the show. But I did it anyway.
And you didn't get knifed?
No, but one guy came up to me, because I meet everyone after all my shows, if anyone wants to kill me. and he had his hands in his hoodie and he came up to me. And I was like, hey, man. And he didn't take him out of his hoodie.
Oh, no.
And I was like, oh, fuck, this is the guy. Jeez. And I was like, hey, how you going? And I put out my hand to shake his hand. And he took only one hand out, left the other one in. And I was like, oh, this is how I die. Oh, but no. He was just nervous.
Yeah.
Or he might have been an amputee. Yeah. I don't know.
That is actually scary, though.
But that freaked me out, just that moment. But that was just all my head. He was just a nervous guy.
Well, I guess, like Josh said, it's more the space you're playing in, the out you have. If we started saying controversial shit, we're not comedians. So it'd be just like we're real cunts.
Yeah.
And do you see being a comedian as an opportunity? Not
to be a cunt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah. No,
thanks for that, John.
Yes, but I always think that as my intention is never to offend. Mm. Like that's never my intention. Yeah. That's always just a byproduct, you know? Like if I went out there, I'm like, I'm Lewis Spears and I'm going to offend the whole crowd. I wouldn't sell any tickets because everyone's just like, oh, that guy's an asshole.
Yeah.
My intention is and should be to make you laugh.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and I'll take dangerous topics or dangerous subjects. My favorite thing is taking something that's objectively not funny and being like, oh, but if you thought about it like this.
Yeah.
Like my favorite laugh is 70-30, which is 70% pissing themselves and 30% going, oh, I don't know about that one.
Yeah.
But you get those people with the next one.
Yes.
You know, like I never try to preach or to voice only one opinion. I try to make fun of all sides because I think there's so much comedy out there that puts like convincing you I'm right ahead of being funny. Like funny's here, I'm right is there. Mm. And I think that sucks. My comedic inspirations were the Chasers and they did their show, The Chasers War on Everything. And if you watch that show, you would have no idea what they actually thought or their actual opinions were because they took the piss out of everyone.
Yeah.
What do you like at funerals?
Yep. Well, mostly crying.
Yeah.
Well, are you really? Like, I feel like a coping mechanism.
Mm.
I definitely, like there was moments where I've gone to funeral, like my nana's funeral or whatever, that we are like when we're in the car, there's opportunities that we're just trying to find moments.
Yeah. No, I've only really been to two funerals, one when I was super young and I didn't get it. And the other one was recently my gran. And yeah, it's like, it's not really a depressing thing. I viewed it more of like, fuck, she did some amazing stuff, you know? And like the eulogies were all funny, most of them anyway, depending on who was doing it. But most of them were funny, which I think it might be just our family, which you would know.
Yeah, definitely.
I think everyone's just a little bit funny or a bit of a shit stirrer.
Yeah.
I thought that was great. I think if there's an opportunity to either get angry about something or to make it, you know, try and turn that darkness into something good, why would you not take that opportunity?
I think that like the last couple of years, there's definitely the sensitivity, politically correctness of the comedy space has definitely amplified. Like Chris Lilley, he's just brought out a new show.
Mm.
And I was a fan of Chris Lilley back in the day. And I'm sort of whatever now. I don't like. I'm sure I could get into watching your show if I check it out.
Summer High was sort of like literally just my school. How it was. So we
apparently everyone's school as well. Like that show's huge in the UK and the US, and you wouldn't think that it would translate, but it's gone like that whole thing's gone global, which mm-hmm. just makes sense as the high school experience.
Yeah. But I think I look at some of the – so his new show that's just come out, Hectic or something, or what, a brand new one that's just – coming
out
on
Netflix.
Yeah,
he's doing like six or so characters and yeah. none of them are in blackface.
Yeah, there's just a tan South African woman.
Which is a damn shame.
Well, yeah, well, I guess he's felt the brunt of that coming from a time where it was kind of acceptable. It just wasn't even critiqued like it is
now. It wasn't blackface.
I think that the thing is that blackface in America is I wouldn't do it, and I think that no one should do it there. And I think no one should really do it now because we know the reasons why.
Yeah.
But in Australia, we didn't really have the huge like minstrel shows and like the whole blackface thing that America did. We had it to some extent, but it wasn't like as popular. It wasn't in movies and all that kind of shit. So I think that I guess that whole blackface thing came from him doing it, came from like just ignorance of like, oh, you know, you just did it because you weren't doing it with a racist intention, but now that it's been seen by a broader audience that, you know, have that history, they see it, and the only thing they see is a racist intention because the only people who did it from where they're from were people racist. Who had that racist intention.
Yeah, John Safran, I remember he did race relations and he had like a full prosthetic face. It was black.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting. That was at a time I remember I was personal training him at that stage and he's telling me about it. I was like, oh. And it came out. There was no sort of nothing said about it.
Yeah.
And so the time that we're in now, what are the sensitivities that you have as someone who really plays in this space?
I don't have to. My thing always comes back to if I check myself and I go, am I doing this because my intention is to piss people off or to make them laugh? It can be both, but the main thing has to be to make people laugh and to bring joy. Pissing people off, bit of fun for me. but I don't, I think that there's, I really like a quote by Patrice O'Neill. He was talking about this before, like he did an interview in like the 90s, I think it was the 90s, where he was talking about rape jokes and there was a person saying that you should never tell them. And he kind of said that, I'm not going to tell anyone what type of joke to make as long as their intent is to make people laugh.
Mm-hmm.
So she was like, so you support rape jokes? And he goes, I don't make them. I don't make rape. I don't think, you know, it's funny, but I've heard them, you know? And I think that's the kind of thing as the darker a subject matter is, the harder it is to make it funny.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of the time when people get offended, it's not so much the subject matter. Maybe it's just the skill level of the person doing it. You know, like so many times I've written down an idea that's quite dark and I've tried to do it and it's not funny and it doesn't work. But then I come back to it 2 years later when I'm a better comic and I've worked out how to make it funny. Like I used to do this joke about sex work in Thailand and like the ping pong shows because I went to one and it was fucking horrible. Like it was just sex trade shit, like you felt really bad about it. And I tried talking about that when I was very early in my career and everyone just felt sad. It took me like 2 or 3 years before I was better to finally get people to laugh at that and then also pass on a positive message of maybe don't go to these things, they're a bit fucked.
How did you actually apply like comedy to it? How did you make it funnier?
Live demo.
What the?
Yeah, I don't know. I just walked through the whole experience of what I thought it was going to be in my head versus what it actually was. Yeah. Like we got flyed and there's this woman, she was going, ping pong show. Yeah. And you're thinking, like the noise that it makes. And you're like, oh, that sounds fun. And that sounds like everybody wants to be there and not because they have kids to feed and they have no skills.
Yeah.
And then we went down an alleyway and down another alleyway and it just got dirtier and darker and we walked in. And it was just this horrible. And you just like the minute I walked in, I saw the girl on stage and I was like, oh, she doesn't want to be here. Mm. Fuck. And then we just tried to leave and they tried to drag us back in because they were all desperate for money. And I was like, I'm not doing this. And, you know, obviously that's not my joke. That's just what actually happened. But yeah, it's just a bad thing. But you can make it funny and still pass on the message of that, you know, a positive thing without just standing up there and telling people not to go to it or only making light of it without like with just going, ha ha, their life sucks. Isn't that funny?
Yeah. Your crowdfunding campaign.
Yeah.
Was that – so, Josh, I don't know if you would have seen Lewis at this time. No. He was – tell us about what you did.
So I was at a stage, I've been doing comedy for 3 years and I knew I wanted to do a comedy special. I planned to do it year two, but I wasn't good enough, so I delayed it a year. And then I got to a stage where I had like a really good hour of stand-up and I wanted to film it properly because the nature of the online thing is most people who watch me, you know, now most people from America and I don't have a visa yet, so they can't see me live, you know, or people live in regional towns and I don't come there yet. So I was like, well, most of the people who like me have not seen my stand-up and potentially won't for like 5 years until I become successful enough. So the solution to that problem is a comedy special. So I approached a bunch of networks and I approached a bunch of distribution companies and all these different people that could fund it, and they all told me that my stuff was too controversial or it's too expensive to do it properly or this or that, or we can do it like this but it has to be this length and you can't joke about this. And I just thought, fuck it, I'm just going to do it myself. So
what are you showing them? Are you like showing them jokes? Here's a list of jokes, guys.
It's hard. So you just, I basically just showed them my, I filmed a show just on a fucking camera, so like really shit, but you can hear that the jokes are funny, you know, so you can get an idea of what it would look like if it was done properly. So you show that to them and they go, all I got was, this is really, really good, but we can't touch it because it's too controversial or this or that. So I just thought, fuck it, I'll do it myself. And I launched a crowd fund and it was going to cost 30 grand. So
it was just Lewis's fee. Production aside.
That was my fee, and then it cost $10 to get an iPhone up the back of the room. So yeah, it was going to cost like 30 grand was what I worked it out to be. So I got all the money I had in the world. I put up 15 of my own and I did a crowd fund and I asked for 15 grand. And I said, if we can get this, I'll pay for half. We'll go halves with my audience and then you guys will have a special. Anyway, I raised that in about 3 hours. And then the first day I raised 30, and then by the end of it, I'd raised $70,000.
Shit.
To this thing, which, and we broke the world record for the biggest comedy special crowdfund ever, which makes me feel a little bit guilty because the previous world record was I want to do my last comedy special before I die of cancer.
Oh, jeez.
I think he deserves it more than me.
Turns out the tall fetish have more money to spend.
But you know what? He's still around, so you know he could do another one.
So it was
one.
All bullshit.
Yeah. So, you know, it's fair.
Was it Kickstarter or what did you actually use?
I used Indiegogo. Uh-huh.
I remember seeing it and I was refreshing going, holy fuck.
It was insane. I knew I could raise 15, but raising 70 was not even in. I didn't even think I could get 30.
Yeah.
But I guess it's just that thing of I always try to be honest, and I was, you know, telling people, I tell my audience how much money I have and how much I pay myself, and I've been doing that for years. And I think they just thought, you know, he's given us so much shit for free. It's it's time to step up, and it worked, and it's to this day the best performance of my life. Like I was just it's the rare moment in my life where everything from the crowdfund to the production to the people that I worked with to my performance itself where I just thought I could not have done that better. And I think that's the only time I've ever, because you know you look back on shit and you go, oh, I could have done this or I could have done that. It's the one thing in my life where I've gone, I fucking nailed that. And so did everyone else who helped. It wasn't just me, of course. It's just fucking amazing. And now it's just sitting on my website. It's like a $5 download thing that you can stream or watch. And it's just something that's always there where if you want to see me live now, you can just go get it. And, you know, now it's kind of made me go, well, I don't have to wait for TV. I don't have to wait for Netflix or any of these people to do it for me. You can just kind of take control. And that looks like how I may do the next one.
The conversations you had with the people that said it was too controversial and then see that happen. I mean, it's always fucking great. You're like...
That's what it was. And then there was another conversation I had with some people from America who were going to fund it, but they were like, yeah, we'll fund it, but we own half of it. Mm-hmm. And in the contract it said it was like, we own half of it in perpetuity forever. Jeez. And I was like, fuck that. I'm only going to get one opportunity to own my comedy special, maybe. You know, someone else might pick it up in the future or whatever. So I thought, you know, I want one for me.
What did you do with the extra cash?
Punted it.
Sketches sale.
Yeah, I just put it back into the hole and I just use it to fund more comedy. You know, I got myself a film space and I've hired an editor and a camera guy to help me put more stuff out, because the biggest struggle when you do stand-up online and radio, those are three completely different jobs. Mm. The only thing you have in common is you're trying to be funny, but really the actual way you do it is so different. So I've managed to hire help with it and fund a tour off it, and yeah, I'm just trying to hold on to it and not be an idiot.
What happens with, so like, remember how Egg Boy recently raised a bunch of cash? What who gets that cash? How does the actual process work?
So
when you get $70,000, how the hell do you
Get? That was the craziest. So what happens is it goes to Indiegogo, it takes it from everyone and they hold it. And then when the crowdfund's over, they just send it to you in bulk. And then it's this, dude, the coolest thing ever was just looking at my bank account, seeing 70 grand in there going, I'm fucking rich. And then, but then you just got to send it all away. You got to send it to all the camera people. You got to send it to the people who do the merch. You got to send it to this and to that. And then you have, you know, what you actually have. So I didn't end up spending 30. I ended up spending a lot more than that because I had this extra money. So I was like, I'd rather just fucking do all the stuff that I cut out. Because I thought I could only raise 15, so I cut out a bunch of stuff. So I thought, well, I'll put all that back in. Mm. So it's like the perfect thing. We got like three extra cameras and all that kind of shit. So it was really, really good. But yeah, you just seeing it there, just the thought in your head of going, I could just run away.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, obviously you can't.
There's only a few people in Australia, like there's probably 20 or 30 people who have created these audiences online, like the Christian Hulls, like you're in that same sort of category. What is it that we don't understand about the audience building and the type of audience that you have versus the audience that you would see on, I'd say, like a hit network or something like that?
Well, now especially now that I've been in both worlds properly, the difference is the people watching you online choose to.
Mm.
That's the main thing where people sit down and they go, today I'm going to listen to the daily talk show. You don't show up anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you're not on a billboard. You're not
yet.
Turn on
soon.
Yeah, soon. But you know, you're not on radio and it's just on. So yeah, you listen to it. And the main difference is people choose to listen to you. So that audience is so much harder to get, which is the downtrade. But when you get them, as long as you're consistent and good and honest, they fucking stay and they'll support you because they sit down and they go, I'm going to turn on a Lewis Spears video or listen to the podcast or whatever. And I think that's the main difference that we noticed, because Luke, who I do the show with, also built his crowd. Is just you earn that crowd with the online thing, whereas the mainstream media thing, it's there and it exists and it's given to you, and you can lose it if you suck, and you can increase it if you're good, but at the end of the day, it's there.
And it's also theirs. So it's SEO.
And it's not yours.
You can lose their audience. Yes. You can build their audience. Mm-hmm. Still not yours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder about like the financial reward of having an audience. How do you know how much your audience can spend?
Well, clearly I had no idea. Yeah. You know, like I had no idea.
Did you actually try and work out the math for the 15 grand thing? Say, I've got 15 grand. I reckon maybe based on my followers, it's X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, well, I kind of was like, I pitched, so the crowdfund, I pitched it as, I want to do a comedy special and I want to make it as easy for people to buy and stream. So I'm going to make it $5. I know if you have a smartphone, you have $5 or you have the ability to get $5.
Yeah.
You know, if
you've
don't.
You've stolen it or you can steal another $5.
Exactly. Yeah. If you don't, you're lying. You have $5. Yeah. You know, you just don't want to give it to me, which is fine, but be honest, you know. Sometimes I get comments like, man, I wish I could watch your special, but can't afford it. It's like, dude, just tell me that you're not going to watch it. Yeah, that's fine. Don't lie.
Yeah.
So that's what my logic was. Everyone has $5 and that's all that I'll ask for.
Mm-hmm.
So I did the math. I couldn't do it in my head now. If however many thousand people give me $5, it'll work. Because I worked out, well, look, on my last tour, I sold like 1,500 tickets and those were 25, whereas the online thing is not constrained by distance or travel or dates or what you're doing that night. So if I can get this many thousand people to give me $5, it should work. But what I didn't really take into account was people giving way more than five. You know, some guy gave me $1,000.
What do you say? I want some nudes. I'm from that tall website.
Yeah.
Send them over, baby.
Crazy. I just said, I'll give you a signed set list and as the reward for $1,000, and I didn't think that anyone would do it.
Fuck yeah.
But someone did it, and that's a crazy thing, because that means that, I guess that means that I'm their favorite.
Yeah.
You know, and which I don't think I'd ever experienced before. I had a lot of people that like me, but I'd never had many people go, oh, you're my favorite guy. Because everyone's favorite is like a special thing. Like mine is Bill Burr. I love Bill Burr. Yeah. He's my favorite. And
something slightly creepy about he's my like saying my favorite. I like that. It's
well,
like,
my favorite comedian. You can't say
you're my favorite. You're my favorite.
Sounds like a stalker thing.
And so was so does that mean that you had like 10,000 plus people all chip in?
I think it was a few thousand people. I can't really remember off the top of my head, but like where it went, because it's been out now. I think we're nearing 10,000 people buying it, and that includes the people contributing. So that's really, really cool.
Do you start sort of like, what is that called when you put your hands in? Like rubbing your hands together and saying, fuck, I can just, if I get some sort of subscription thing and get all these cunts paying me $15 a month, I'm going to like.
Yeah, but that's, I don't want to do that. I want to make my shit, I always want to make my shit accessible because at the end of the day, I'm doing this because I want to perform as much as possible to the most people as I can. And you can't do that by ripping people off or just trying to get money.
So how do you know what you're worth then? And do you think that as artists or comedians, do people tend to undervalue?
Definitely undervalue. And that's a big problem with me. Like my first tour, I did a national tour and I only charged $20 for tickets. And then I got to the end of it and I had made no money. Like I made a little bit of money, but not enough to fund me to the next tour or to fund the next tour. It was enough to live for 6 months. And I was like, well, that doesn't work. And, and I think that a lot of people do undervalue themselves in terms of ticket price or stuff. It's like, it's like a weird thing of some people undervalue, most people undervalue a lot where they think, oh, I'm not worth it. Or I don't know why people are listening to me or, you know, this video only got 100 views. That means that I suck. And then there's the other side, which is people overvaluing themselves and that's just trying to get take as much shit. I've always been about giving. I'm just giving as much shit away for free so that when I ask for something once, they'll turn up. And that's just what it was because I did, you know, I did comedy online since 2012 just for free, never asking for a thing. And then, you know, 5 years after that, I said, I need one thing and they showed up.
Yep. Did you learn this? Like, because I mean, this is the Gary Vee jab, jab, right hook. Yeah, it's like that's exactly what he does. Free, free, free. Please give me your money.
How do you work out what the ask is?
I don't. I think it was it. Ultimately, it was a combination of my dream, which was to do a special and to be a stand-up comedian, and then also because I was honest about that dream, that became a problem for them because they were like, oh, we know you care so much about this and we know you're performing and you do this and that, but we can't see you. We want to see you. So like it was a combination between what I wanted to do and what they wanted to do. And then the solution to that was the comedy special. You know, they were like, we want to see you live. And I was like, well, I can't show it to you unless you come. And they're like, I'm in fucking Sweden. I'm like, dude, I'm probably never going there. So then you give them
could probably crowdfund a trip, a Euro trip. Lewis Spears does Euro.
That's true.
I think like the other thing too is it's like you talk about the 5 years prior. People see the big amount. There's an appealing nature to saying, and I do it too when, especially when I was starting to get into video production, you talk about these big amounts that you make. But then what people don't realize is like, okay, 5 years, if you take $70,000 and put it over 5 years, you're at like minimum wage territory. You know, has that been something that like that you've been thinking about in the future where it's like, how do I actually get a sustained salary?
I think that's what I've started thinking about more now. And that's come from my problem of undervaluing myself where I talked to just recently I talked to a bunch of people and I was like, how much would you actually pay to see me? And all these people that like me were like, oh, I'd pay $60. And I was charging like $25. And I was like, oh, well, fuck. I'm too cheap. And, you know, that would be reflected in how much money was left over at the end and all that kind of stuff. And because I do all my tours myself up until recently, I've just finally got someone to help me out with it. So I never really had all these people like going, oh, you're way too cheap. And now I look at my peers that are on the same level and they're charging like $70 a ticket and I'm not going to do that. So now what I've kind of realized is that if I really want to give them as much comedy as I want, I need to start making enough money to fund it properly.
100%. I've always found it like when it comes to charging, what's the amount that comes to mind? Add a little bit more because usually it's always
we tend to undervalue. And the other thing too is it's like this still is coming from a place – of serving people, right? It's like realizing that the only way that you're going to be able to serve people is by making enough cash that's sustainable.
Yeah, so that's what I've really taken seriously this year is, and that's also the opposite end of like, well, if I want to make money, I need to start spending a bit as well to like get what I need. Like, so this year I was like, well, I need enough money to fund an international tour and that I can lose money on, because you generally lose money the first time you go a place. Yeah. So I need to make enough money to make losing money justified. Yeah. So I was like, well, I'll get a warehouse and I'll get a guy and I'll employ him to help me make videos. And then I just, you know, put it out there and I said, I've got a Patreon. And I said, look, this I'm spending more money. I need some more patrons. Then people were like, oh yeah, I have noticed he's doing more. So I'll jump on and I'll support him a little bit. Whereas before, maybe I would have been like, oh, I'll get a guy when I get more Patreon supporters, or I'll rent a space when I sell more tickets. But sometimes it's a matter of working harder and giving more, so that they kind of go, oh, he's working harder and giving more. Maybe I'll contribute more as well, or I'll see a show, or I'll buy a poster, or whatever. So yeah, I think that's the thing. I've always been hyper focused on giving as much shit away for free, and then when I do charge, being as fair as possible. And to me, in my mind, that meant as cheap as I could make it. Whereas I've found that from talking to people who actually like me, is they don't mind. They're happy to pay a normal amount of something. They're not offended by it. You know, like when I did the crowdfund, all these people messaging me were going, thank you so much and for doing this so I can give you something and help you achieve something. And I was like, well, no, thank you. And I think that's something that a lot of entertainers maybe should realize, is that it is a mutually beneficial transaction. You're entertaining and they're giving you something. They're getting entertained and giving you a bit of money, and the world fucking spins.
I mean, maybe it's hard because the thing you do is something you love, and then you're like,
that's another
this
thing.
Is like, it's not easy for me, but it's like, this is a bit like...
As if I get paid for this.
Like, you could go to LA right now if you had money for a holiday, and then you could go and do a bunch of stand-up in LA, and you'd feel like, fuck, this is a holiday.
Like cheating.
Especially once you start, if you got paid. I guess that's the mindset of big comedians. You hear Joe Rogan talk about...
Yeah.
He kind of feels like... From what I gather is, he's like, fuck, like this is amazing where I am. Like, they're all super grateful for having turned on this floodgate of money doing something they fucking love.
If you like the if you love the process, then it becomes, you know, a lot easier.
Yeah.
With partnerships and teamwork and stuff like that, how do you reconcile that with what you're doing?
I think that's what it is. Like, and you find yourself, when someone offers you a job that you don't want to do, you quote them a stupid amount of money.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if they say yes, great, then doing the shit job is worth it because I'll get heaps of money. Yeah. And if they say no, great, I don't have to do the job. And so sometimes the opposite is like, oh, you want me to do comedy? I'll do it for $10. I love comedy.
Yeah.
You got to find that middle ground.
Mm. So with... your radio show and what you develop going forward with that online is, you know, what is the what's your thoughts on the team dynamic of it? So two individuals coming together and doing a show.
Yeah, well, it's really good. So me and Luke, we're friends, and we never wanted to do a radio show together when we started being friends. We just were friends because we liked each other. We met through comedy and we built a good friendship and a relationship, and we started doing online stuff together, and every time he grew, I grew, and it was just, you know, tide rises all ships kind of thing, and mixed with a really good friendship. And then I knew a few people in radio and I thought, oh, well, we do shit all the time, but we've never actually created a project. We've collaborated, but we've never like built something new. So why don't we try radio? And that, it just felt like the most natural thing in the world. And it really demonstrated to me, also after seeing a lot of other radio teams and radio shows that fall apart or don't do that well, just comes down to people getting put in a room that don't know each other.
Yeah, and forced to be friends.
Yeah,
and it's like friendships can't be forced.
Yeah. No, you can't. Like, end of the day, that's why Hamish and Andy are so big and so genuinely loved by people, because it's a genuine friendship. If they didn't have a radio show, they'd be hanging out anyway.
Yeah.
Whereas so many of these radio shows is like a bachelorette contestant and a guy who hosted a TV show 2 years ago and then some dude who kicked a ball really good. But they would never hang out together. So it reminds me of like those undercover ticket inspectors when they walk through the train and they're wearing like, it's like some 40-year-old Indian dude and then like a 30-year-old 6'3" lesbian and then some giant 6'2" white guy. It's like, you guys aren't friends. And that's why I know that you're ticket inspectors. Yeah, yeah.
And I'm fucking out of here.
Yeah.
But they definitely could do a regional breakfast show.
Exactly. Like, yeah, that's what they are. It's like the undercover ticket inspectors. It's like undercover friendship. It's not real.
So funny. Something funny that you do online is spot nebs. Uh-huh. Hashtag spot nebs. Josh, have you seen that?
Yes, I have. Yeah, you should, like Tommy, always, you are constantly showing me every single time there's a great photo.
Well, basically, it's it's like paparazzi. It's like fan-populated paparazzi.
Yeah.
Where people...
crowdsourced paps.
It is. See, it really is. Yeah. Crowdsourcing paparazzi.
People see Lewis and take a photo from ages away. Who started that? Did you start that or someone... thought, there's a big tall guy. That looks like Lewis.
I don't know if you know this, man, but you can't actually take a photo of yourself from across the street. So I didn't start it.
No, but no, as in, did you say, if you see me, you get fucking a piece of candy?
Okay, it kind of was pretty... It was pretty organic. So this is when Snapchat was like a big new thing. Someone just took a photo of me and they sent it to me. I can't remember if I came up with spot names or they captioned it. But anyway, they just took a photo and I thought it was funny and then... I just screenshot it and I didn't post it. But then like a month later, someone else took one and then I just took a screenshot and I didn't post it. And then I just had nothing to put up. So I just chucked it up and it was just me from across the street just looking at my phone or whatever. And it got heaps of likes. People thought it was funny. And then I just had this little caption of going, if you were just taking the piss out of the people that did that, I was like, if you want to take a photo of me and send it to me instead of saying, hi, follow me here. And people thought that was so funny that they just started doing it. And to the point where there was a little bit in my career where I was like, man, I am fucking dying because no one's saying hello anymore. No one's coming up to me. But if people was doing that less, they would prefer to take the photo and then send it to me. So I was getting more of them and less hellos in public.
We're talking with Stringer we had on the show last week and it was talking about me becoming a meme.
Yeah.
And do you plan to become a meme or does it evolve?
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially what's happened. You've become a meme in that
Yeah, respect. Well, that's what it is. Like, that's like, it's not a viral thing, but that's just, I never think you can plan that meme thing. You can only embrace it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can kind of take control a little bit after it happens. Like DJ Khaled is a perfect example.
Yeah.
Like he started doing that. Everyone was just laughing at him and he was like, oh, okay, I can do this. If you want me to be that guy, I'll be that guy.
Yeah.
And it fucking works.
Well, is it, who was it? Howard Stern, Josh, saying that phrase?
Oh, yeah. He calls himself the king of all media. And it all of a sudden started to stick.
Logan Paul, he's like, I'm the number one podcast, biggest podcast in the world. And even on video lately, he's
episode
like...
Episode one, he was like, biggest podcast in the world.
Yeah, yeah. It's now climbing. Yeah. And even on one of his recent videos, he's like, dude, it's fucking actually
it's
happening.
It's the self-fulfilling prophecy type of thing.
You have to do that. Like, I remember, you got to have that self-belief.
Mm.
Like, I still do. I always, before I get on stage, I'd go, I'm the best. And me and my friends used to do that for us when we were starting out. And we sucked.
Yeah.
But we were like, let's be the fucking best. And every now and then it would happen where you'd be the best comedian on the lineup.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, fuck yeah, I am the best. And it becomes true. I'm not the best yet. But that's the mindset, you know. I wanna become that. So you gotta tell yourself that, otherwise you won't be. Like Dave Chappelle, you know, he's probably the best stand-up in the world and he starts one of his recent comedy specials going, I'm the best comedian in the world and it's comedy's getting too easy for me. And and his whole hour is just about how fucking good he is at stand-up and how he can do anything and make you laugh. Yeah. And he's right.
Yeah.
So he probably wouldn't be right if he didn't think that. And I bet you he thought that before he was.
What's your international audience like?
It's criminals. It's growing more. So before it was like 90% Australia, but now it's like 60% America.
Interesting.
So it's kind of growing there. So
That's probably the best thing, right?
Well, that's just, I think that's where I picture myself going. I'm going to LA and New York next month for a whole month because I in my head, that's where my career ends up, is either LA or New York because the stand-up scene's really good. I may hate it. That's why I'm going, you know, because I want to scope it out.
Have you been to the States before?
I've never been. Okay, sure. I've only ever been to Thailand. It's about as far away from Australia. Led
down a back alleyway.
Yeah, I didn't like that. There's
a lot of... I know you were making fun of the Skechers stuff, but their presence in the US, they've got a lot of Skechers stores.
That's good. Especially I'll just walk around just king hitting people
with Skechers. So East Coast and West Coast, you're going to spend, a couple of weeks in each one?
Yeah, so I'm going to do New York for 2 weeks, and I know a bunch of stand-up comedians. Well, I don't know them. I've just internet talked to them friends. Online, just internet people. So I'm just going to link up with everyone in New York that I know. Then I'll go to LA and link up with everyone there that I know and try and perform as much as possible and see it and do everything. And then kind of, because I realize that's probably years away of me actually moving there. But if I like one more than the other, I'll be like, well, now I'm going to be working towards living in New York or living in LA and trying to do that. Because I think I've always been like such a long-term goal. First, I love setting impossible goals. Mm. Like I wanted to do the comedy special. I knew I was going to do that year one and I knew it wasn't going to happen for ages, but that was always the goal. And then I did the special and for about 8 months I felt really lost because I didn't have this thing that seemed fucking impossible.
Yeah.
And now I think it's blow up in America and that's impossible now, but I may do it.
Is there a pecking order? Like does it feel like, I guess from being online where you get to put it up wherever you want and if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. The comedy scene on a actual on the ground level, are you going to, you know, thinking about going to LA, is there, do you have to sort of stay in your lane? We're all over here doing our thing.
Well, I don't really ultimately know, but I have noticed that the people that blow up online are so much more welcoming to other people because I feel like people mostly know that we benefit each other. You know, the bigger your friends are, the bigger you will be when you do a video with them and all that kind of stuff.
It's democratized as well, right? So it's like it is that whole.
It's quite a merit-based thing. Mm. If you're good and consistent, you will get big online, pretty much. There's obviously exceptions to that, but generally, I've noticed that in Melbourne, a lot of the people from the traditional scene don't like the online thing because there's this mentality of oh, wait to get chosen and wait to get picked. and then these online guys come out of nowhere a few years ago and just start selling tickets with no radio, no TV, no one putting them in that position, no one saying, yes, you're allowed, or no gala spot or even a good venue in the comedy festival. And then all of a sudden these 20-something-year-old people come out of nowhere and start selling more tickets than these people who've been doing it for 10 years. And this whole reaction was like, oh, you guys are skipping the queue.
Yeah.
And then we're all standing there going, there's no queue.
Didn't you get
just
the memo?
Just go and get your food.
Yeah.
You know, it's sometimes with the traditional thing, a lot of them act like you selling a ticket takes one away from me. But I've noticed with the guys that are all blown up online, we're all completely different people from different backgrounds. But whenever any one of us does well, the other people are like, fuck yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. What does your narrative look like going back, say, before you'd sort of built an audience? Mm. What were those key milestones? Do you have it like clear in your head?
Yeah, I would say it was the first one was when I realized that the online thing was comedy, because I did it for almost a year just for fun. Because without even realizing, because there weren't when I started, it was 2012, there were really no big consistent online Australian personalities other than Alex Williamson, who I think paved the way for all of us. But when I started, it was uncool to like Australian YouTubers or even to think of becoming one.
It was an interesting, I remember going to a conference called Game On, and it was like a pre-VidCon in Australia type of thing. And it was...
Where was that?
It was in Sydney. It was when I spoke to an audience of one.
Oh, this is the one I saw you at.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
and yeah, it was like the YouTube scene was a very specific underground. It's like very blue hair.
Even VidCon last year I went, Jules Lund had some tickets and it was like, yeah, it's still the same thing. But it's not the same as the States still, but...
Well, because VidCon won't give any fucking tickets to people who are actually big here. because we all say cunt. Like that's what it comes down to. Like so I like you know, I reached out to VidCon a few times and they knocked us back, and I'm not the biggest, but I'm one of, you know, if you're talking like actual YouTubers, and there were people 10 times the size of me that reached out and got knocked back because they were too Australian, it came down to, which is swearing and drinking and stuff like that.
So is that adpocalypse thing, is that actually something that you have to worry about?
I don't, thankfully, because I have ticket sales. But if I wasn't doing stand-up, I'd be fucked. You know, like thank God I've got, you know, ticket sales and people can download the comedy special, because, I'm not – like I reckon I used to make three times as much on ads as I used to. And I'm bigger now than what I was.
So that, like, that milestone thing that you were talking about, so the year end started realizing –
when I realized that it was comedy, and then I started thinking about stand-up, and – then it, another thing was when I left the group that I was working with, because I wanted to do stand-up and nobody else did, and so it was kind of like a natural thing of, well, I need to do stand-up, you know.
Were they doing mainly like sketches? Was that what that was? Or what was the sort of... What
it was just like a different goals growing up, you know what I mean? Like, we started it when I was 18, the other people were like 17. It was just, it just grew apart quite naturally. So then I was like, well, fuck, I need to be... Lewis Spears, because at the time I was going under a name Nebs, which was just a nickname from high school. So I was like, well, fuck, well, I can't be like, welcome to the stage, Nebs. That sucks. So I left the group. I started a new, my page got deleted on Facebook because it was too much fuck stuff on it. And it was like right after I left the group. So there was like no, go and check out Lewis who's doing stuff over there. Was none of that. So I had to start from scratch. And I had this moment of like, fuck, I don't know if I can build it from zero again.
What was the audience like when you left, in size wise?
Not that big, like 20,000 or so.
Still,
which is chunk. Still there, but then it got deleted, so it was back to zero. So then I started again, and I was like, oh fuck, I don't know if I can do it, but because it was first time working by myself and first time building from zero as well. And then there was a moment where I had this one video that went crazy viral, where I just did Ping a Pete, the police are planning a party. And that still goes that's around so today, where it's just, it's like a police ad about road safety, where they're going, the police are planning a party. And they go, there's lollipops. And they're like doing mouth swabs for drugs and just like a parody thing. So I reacted to it and I was like, oh, that sounds fucking sick. And I did this whole thing of like, oh, I'm going to go to this party. And then that went crazy viral. And I was like, oh no, I can do this by myself. And then it was just like, I just kept doing it. And the other notable milestones was getting on stage at the Comics Lounge for the first time. And I did okay. I didn't tank on my first comedy set. Tanked hard on my second.
What was that like?
Did it blow the wind out of your sails?
Well, yeah, because I did my whole set and I researched gigging. And I went up there going, I'm going to tank and that's okay. And then I got up and I did pretty well. Like, I didn't smash, but I did pretty well. And
did
I got
you tell
stage.
People? Was it like your primed audience or was it just...
No, it was just the Comics Lounge. So it was like just the perfect, just strangers who didn't know me. So it was a genuine response, you know. So I got up there because I also knew that if you get up in front of fans, it's a soft crowd. It's hard to bomb in front of them. So
you're
I
primed
wanted
to laugh.
Wanted to do it properly. Yeah. So got up there and I did pretty well, and I was like, fuck, if I did pretty well on my first gig, I'm going to be amazing. And I did my second, my third, and my fourth, and I tanked so hard on all the next ones. I was like, oh man, clearly I fluked the first one.
Is it no laughs, or is it an internal feeling where it's just you feel like you're fucking every minute of it?
It was both. It was like I got on being like, going to smash it again, and then just silence. So I was like, oh shit. And then I was quite bad for a while, and then I started getting better and better. And
what are the tells, by the way, that you notice around whether something's tanking? Like, what do you do? Do you start speaking a bit louder?
Yelling, fucking flat out yelling.
Well, what's good is it happens less. It still does happen, but it happens a lot less now because I have backup material to fall onto. I generally only ever don't do well now if I'm trying something new for the first ever time and maybe I'm wrong, or maybe I haven't remember it properly, or it's just a little bit new. But I haven't like properly bombed for a while now, which is good. If it was still happening at this point, you'd be worried and maybe thinking maybe it's not for me.
So have you got material in your head then where it's like if shit hits the fan, I've got a real easy confidence booster that I can just throw out there?
So now what's great is now when I'm testing material, I start off with something really good that always works pretty much, and then I chuck in my stuff that's a gamble, and if that tanks, no worries because I finish it with something awesome too.
Yeah.
You give them a shit sandwich. and then eventually, you know, that stuff that's in the middle becomes good, and then you can start opening with that, and then you replace the shit stuff with some more new shit, and you just kind of work it like that.
Do you listen back to all your sets?
Like So I record them. I've got this awesome app called, I think it's called Otter, that transcribes it as well, which is so good. So now when, because before what I would do is I'd record it, and if I did really well, I would sit there and I'd write it out listening to it. But now I can, if I smash, I can just take out the text and fix the spelling errors that the AI's made, which is great. It saves me a lot of time.
Do you search cunt to see how many times you say cunt in the show?
Well, no, I use cunt as a weapon. It's I try not to swear as because I do know that I swear a lot normally in conversation, but when I'm on stage, I try to use it properly because that was a bad habit of mine when I started, was I would just swear so much and then if a punchline had a swear word in it, wouldn't hit as hard.
Yeah, really. And so when you were at the stage of those first few shows, what was your audience at, like on from a online perspective? Were you back at the 20,000 or?
Yeah, so basically my page got deleted and it took another year to get it back to where it was. And through that year, I was just, because, you know, those people still know you. Yeah. They just need to find you again. Yeah. So it wasn't as hard as starting from nothing because they were there. They just were like, oh, fuck, why isn't he showing up on Facebook? And they'd search me. And I kind of got them back with a couple of viral things and got new people. So I think when I did my first tour, I was only at like 28,000 people or so, which is quite big, but if you're doing a tour, pretty small. And I just did the Melbourne Comedy Festival. I did 12 shows there. In like a little 60-seater conference room where my head touched the roof. A funny story from that is, as a joke, I used to rub my forehead on the roof, which was really funny, and it would vibrate and make a stupid noise, which was hilarious and such a good joke until I had to pay to get the sweat stain removed.
Really?
Yeah. And then I toured around. I did every state except for Tassie, and I think in Brisbane I booked a 176-seater and I sold 17 tickets.
Oh, no.
And that was humbling. But it turned out to be one of the best shows of the tour.
To the 17 people?
Yeah, just because I just went on there and acknowledged it and people were just kind of like, ah, well, he fucked up, but we're here.
He fucked up.
So, you know, it's just from perseverance and keeping on doing it. I went to Brisbane last year and I sold out 450.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Went from my smallest show ever to my biggest.
What's arriving for you? You know, like if you think about these times, all these stories of rubbing the head, like this seems to be the fun. You know, it's like it's hard because it's so hard as you're doing it.
Yeah.
Getting 17 people is no fun for anybody.
17 is fucking great for us.
I mean, it'd be great for us.
Could you imagine 17?
Seven would be
the momentum would be feeling.
When you book flights and pay for venue hire at an Airbnb, 17 tickets doesn't even pay for breakfast.
When I did the game on, literally there was one person in the crowd when I was talking.
At least you were getting paid, dude.
Yeah.
You were an employee. You got paid, bro.
No guarantees. But yeah, it's your show.
What's arriving for you? Do you see it like that? You know, like getting to this or?
Well, it feels like the beginning stages of big, you know. Like it's not huge, but I went to Brisbane and in front of 450 people. And I did an hour and a half and like I had the skills to back that up and it was definitely my best show that I'd done, and I've got this comedy special and a body of work out there that people can go, and it's just constantly ticking over of new people watching and finding me online, and I've got a guy working for me to help me put out more stuff. It really feels like I'm right on like I've hit a plateau and I'm just about to hit the next flight of stairs. Like I feel really, really good about what's coming next, because I know that I think I'm through the scary stage, you know, where I might run out of money or you know, I'm not rolling in it, but I've got enough to last until the next tour, and that's all I need.
Do you feel that in this new age of sort of, you know, building an audience, Are we going to have people who are known around Australia? So, for instance, you look at like the Hughesies mm-hmm. of the world, where it's like they're Australian icons or whatever, or within Australia, they go down the street and everyone mm-hmm. knows them. Yeah. Do you think that that is the destiny for what you're doing? Or do you think that with all of these audiences, they're the sort of 1,000 true fans or the 10,000 or the 20 or the 100,000 true fans?
I don't think that will happen. I don't think that, well, I don't know, maybe. But what I've noticed now is like when I, so the Melbourne Comedy Festival's on, so all of the people who are big online and do stand up as well are in the same city. So there's me, Luke Kidgel, Isaac Butterfield, who's new, Frenchie, Alex Williamson, Fairbairn Films, they're new as well. Between us, three of us have like over 1 million people who follow them. Mm-hmm. I've got like 500,000, so does Luke. Between all of us, there's probably about 5 million people following all of us as a group. And when we walk through the city, no one recognizes all of us. Mm-hmm. Like one guy will go up to Frenchie and be like, Frenchie, I love you. And they'll see all of us, don't know what we look like.
Yeah.
Or some guy will come up to me and be like, Lewis, man, I love your stuff. And I do a fucking radio show with Luke.
Yeah.
He has no idea who he is.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that the future is just grabbing your type of person and holding on to them. And we always laugh in the city when someone comes up to us and we go, oh, that's one of Frenchie's, because he's got like a mullet and a flannel. Yeah. Or it's like, oh, it's one of mine. He's like an emo kid.
They get you to take the photo type of thing.
Yeah. I've had that so many times where I'll take the photo and I think that's fucking awesome. Everyone just finding their crowd of people. And that what that also means is that, you know, if I do a video with Frenchie, I'm being opened up to a whole audience that I would never attract on my own. That means that the more we work together, the more we have so much more to grow.
Yeah.
Even the people that are 10 times the size of me, if they're not attracting the people that I am, I have so much to give them by working with them.
Yeah. You said it perfectly. Rising tide raises all boats. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's why I think the guys who are big online, the kind of new wave of comedians I found have been so much more supportive and welcoming than the traditional industry in comedy, which is changing a little bit, because I feel like they're kind of realizing that, oh shit, maybe television isn't the future. Maybe Channel 10 can't make my career anymore.
Well, I mean, what does mainstream mean? Like what Nothing I wonder now. Is it's like, what does it mean, say, in 5 years' time when you go into an Uber? At the moment, they're either, you know, they've got like Gold FM, Fox, they've got like one of the radio stations in Melbourne. What happens in 5 years? What's on the screens at bars? What are people?
Well, yeah, that's why I think everyone's just listening to their own shit. Like I was in a, I drove around a friend who has a Tesla, and being in that thing, I was like, it's got Spotify, it's got podcasts, it had like four different apps of just whatever the fuck you could think of. It was just in the car.
Yeah.
And I thought, there wasn't a radio button. Like there was not a radio button on that thing. There was no dial. I was like, oh, okay, it's fucked. You know? And the same thing with television. I go to my friend's house who's young and he's doing really well, and he's got enough money to build an entertainment system in his house. And on his massive fucking television, it's YouTube.
Yeah.
You know, just auto playing stuff that's recommended for him. And then if he gets bored of that, he gets the remote and hits the Netflix button.
Mm.
It's not, I think the future is just everyone's specific interest, and there is no mainstream anymore. Like when's the last time, like you guys obviously have friends in radio, but when have you talked to a friend that doesn't work in the entertainment industry? When's the last time they said, oh man, you know what I heard on radio the other day? Do you know what I watched on TV? Never.
I worked like, at a...
this guy on Joe Rogan said that, or I was listening to this podcast. You should check it out.
I remember going into Envato, where I used to work, tech company, over 200 people in the office. I was on... Hamish and Andy did a whole segment on there, and I walk in the next day like a top dog, and there was literally one person in HR who has a commute who heard it.
Yeah.
It's like no one is listening to
the whole show.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that's what being in radio really taught us is you start every single talk break when the song finishes. I go, it's Luke and Lewis, because no one listens to the whole show and you have to tell them what they're listening to. Yeah. And then so often throughout the talk break, which goes for 4 minutes, you've got to keep using each other's names because people will turn in halfway through and they'll hear two voices, have no idea who they am until I go, great idea, Luke. Thanks, Lewis. And they go, oh, Luke and
so
Lewis.
So much resetting.
Yeah. You know,
I mean, hook, like forward hooking something is useless. Yeah. Like I've pulled over and searched something. They're like, coming up after this is this. I'm like, that's interesting. I'm just going to search it right now. Yeah. Pull over and type.
Yeah.
Like, it seems archaic.
Mm. Like we found, because what we did with radio is Luke and I folded it into our online content. And so we filmed every show and we did a podcast and we made sure we set that up and we owned it ourselves instead of the radio owning it. And we noticed that when we were filming and we were editing clips and putting them out there, Luke did a tour and then I did one 6 months later. So when we were putting effort into our socials and putting videos out, people showed up to Luke's show with in jokes. So we had a thing of like Savoys are the best biscuits. Mm-hmm. Some guy brought 40 boxes of Savoys to Luke's show, gave one to every person in the audience.
That's pretty funny.
Like he would have spent like $60 on a stupid radio joke and people were showing up giving him gifts and wearing t-shirts that we talked about and just shit like that. And then because we were putting so much effort into the socials of the radio show, our personal stuff started to slip a little bit. Mm-hmm. So me and Luke went, well, we need to focus on us because we have tickets to sell and we are each of our own main priority. Mm. Luke and Lewis is a project we're doing, but Lewis Spears and Luke Kidgel are the main thing. So we stopped making videos for Luke and Lewis. We started again for our individual stuff. I had my tour 6 months later. Not a single person came from the radio show.
Yeah, interesting.
Which means no one's coming to the show from listening to us on radio. It was all the online stuff we were doing.
Yeah.
It was all the podcasts, all the videos, everything like that. There wasn't a single person who heard us on radio and thought, I'm going to buy a ticket to go and see them, or I'm going to check them out on Instagram or Facebook, you know.
I mean, the last few years of Hamish and Andy, I literally was just watching their snippets online. Yeah. I felt like I was listening to their show. Mm. I remember I was an avid listener at one point, but then that slipped, but then I felt like I was still getting everything, getting the joke.
But when you don't have that commute or whatever, or if it changes, like I heard a stat around having long podcasts and the fact that like if it's over an hour, people listen to less than 50% or whatever, but it's like it's still good when you consider like a radio show. Like you definitely aren't listening to a radio show from start
to finish. As opposed to what? Yeah. Listening to 30 seconds of a radio show and then changing it because you hear an ad?
Yeah.
That happens way more, you know? Like, and I've talked to Hamish and Andy about this, about what you were saying was they would talk to people that are genuinely huge fans of them, be like, I listen to your show all the time, but they would only ever reference talk breaks that they posted on Facebook or YouTube and they feel like they're listening to it and they are.
Yeah.
They're just listening to little chunks. Absolutely. But they're not actually listening to it on radio or even listening to the full show.
That's why I think video is so powerful. Video, I don't think a lot of people argue you don't need to film your show and all that sort of thing.
Yes, you do.
But when it comes to actually being able to have snippets and being able to share it, for us, The full show as video is just a nice to have that will slowly build over time. People will open it up in a tab. Mm. It might be the choice for some people. But the real benefit is
clips.
from the show, we'll have a clip and it will go up on Instagram and then that might inspire people to listen. But also, that might be the
Lewis
thing.
Lewis is bullying Josh about sketches.
Exactly.
Yeah. I have to listen to this.
Exactly. And so I think there's so much power in that video content as well.
Yeah, definitely. And that's what we made such a big deal out of filming every show. And the radio people were like, I think you're focusing too much on filming the show than actually doing the show. And we said, I think you're a dinosaur. because we noticed like, you know, we started on Modern Digital, which has no listeners, which was kind of the point. So we could be shit and it didn't matter while we were learning. And that we had people calling the show and they were like, what the fuck? How are you getting this? And it's like, because we're doing videos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's super interesting. We'd love to have you back on when we're in our new
studio.
Absolutely
not.
I'm just worried about the height, the door height I'm concerned about.
I'm used to that.
It's, what is it, 2200. You'll fit.
So I've got 20 metres.
No, 2,200 millimetres.
Oh, so I've got 2 centimetres to spare.
Is that really?
I'm 2 metres.
No, you're, it's 20 centimetres. So you're 2 metres. Yeah. So you're 2,000. The door frame is 2,200.
Okay.
Glad we got that. Ceiling height's 2,400.
That's good.
Otherwise we could. Or we could like winch you up with the rope or whatever through you'll be the top bit.
You'll have to come back in, when we are in our new space. Josh will give you a free pair of Skechers.
Great. I'd love to come in when it's not Easter. This is a real fuck around.
I know. Easter Monday. Crazy.
Well, it's a public holiday, boys.
I've definitely overdone the whole egg thing. That's okay.
I was prepared to just ignore it. We're going to rope Lewis into I'm not pretending for you guys. This is your podcast, not mine.
It's 2012.
This is pre-recorded. We recorded it last year.
That's not true.
No, mate, it's exciting seeing what's happening. I'm looking forward to seeing you walk up that next flight of stairs.
Yeah, it's really cool. Thanks for having me on, boys.
The Daily Talk Show, hi@thedailytalkshow.com. Do you get many emails? Do people email you ever, or is it all DMs and shit?
Follow me on Instagram, guys. Send me a letter.
No, but do people actually,
I've got an email thing for my podcast.
I like the email thing.
Emails are good. They're all thought out. I'm going to sit down and write an email. When it's a DM, it's just like a dick pic or fuck you.
You just need to actually read them out. That's a bit that we tell people the email address. But do send us an email. It's a Daily Talk Show. We'll see you tomorrow, which is Tuesday.
Your address.
Hi@thedailytalkshow.com.
There you go.
And also, we have a PO box. Do you have a PO box?
No. She's yours.
Seriously. PO Box 400, Abbotsford, Victoria 3067.
If you want to send me a letter, that's the way.
We'll send it through. Have a good one, guys.